Shoshana Zolti's on. I just wanted to wait till she arrived.
Yeah, wonderful.
She's sponsoring this evening's lecture in memory of her father, whose yahrzeit is today, Bo Bayom HaRav Chaim Meir Ben Yehuda Leib. I understand that he was a Talmid Mugava Baruch Ber Leibowitz, and Dr. Zolti, of course, is also a scholar on women's learning. That's her field. She wrote a book many years ago, one of the first books on the topic, All Your Women Should Be Learned, if I remember the title of the book. It's been a while since I read it. And thank you, Shoshana, for that, for the sponsorship. And without further ado, Dr. Naomi, a pleasure to welcome you back for week three of this ongoing series on the Beis Yaakov and the interwar years and all kinds of interesting things. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. First of all, thank you to Shoshana Zolti, and I owe a lot to Shoshana and her book, and now we're in personal contact also. So thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for making that happen. And I'm really honored that this talk is going to be sponsored in memory of Shoshana's father. It's very moving. And I always have my own father in mind when I think about these subjects. Some of us were very lucky to have fathers who encouraged our intellectual pursuits. And I don't know for a fact that that's true of Shoshana's father, but I imagine that it is. So for this class, I just want to play around with a few ideas. I said five, I think there's four and a half maybe. I was thinking about five ways of looking at Beis Yaakov, or another alternative way is thinking about the myths about Beis Yaakov and how we might revise them with some more information about the movement. So some of them fit into that category. And I think the notion of Beis Yaakov as a Baal Tshuva movement is also a little surprising, because nobody talks about Sarah Schneer as Baalas Tshuva. Nobody talks, I hope, and maybe I'll just translate in case there's someone there that doesn't know what a Baal Tshuva is. Baal Tshuva is someone who returns to Judaism. And people don't normally associate this, I think, with the interwar period. The interwar period was a period of great secularization. So the idea that there was also a Baal Tshuva movement is something that I think is a little counterintuitive. And that Beis Yaakov was a Baal Tshuva movement was also a little counterintuitive. And but I think it does illuminate something about the movement that is obscured if you just assume that it's a kind of continuation of Orthodox life as always lived. So, you know, a way of looking at the revolution. What kind of revolution was it? Well, one kind of revolution it was the Baal Tshuva movement. And I'm curious to know, in the Q&A, I'm hoping to talk not so much so I could get some ideas from you, because these are ideas that are sort of half-baked in progress. I didn't work this out in the book. I'm not sure it occurred to me when I was writing the book, but I think it occurred to me just a few months ago. So what do I mean that Beis Yaakov was a Baal Tshuva movement? I could almost start from any of these pictures, but let's start from the one that's in the middle, which I actually just found last night. I've been working with so many of these pictures that I actually just see a picture on, and you Google something and Google, and I actually recognize a few of the girls or the women in this picture. And the woman that I recognize in this picture is the one in the middle with the white shirt. I'm assuming she's the teacher. And her name is Gutta Sternbuch. And she wrote a memoir about Beis Yaakov called Gutta Sternbuch. And she also happened to be a friend of the family. And I spent some time in her house in Switzerland. I could talk about Gutta Sternbuch, give a whole class about her. But I just want to say one of the things that she writes in her memoir. So this is a woman who grew up in a frum home. I think they were ger, which was typical of the Beis Yaakov clientele, let's say, and went to Chavat Zeles, which was an Orthodox school in Warsaw, went to the Beis Yaakov seminary. So it seems as if this is a frum person from the core constituency of Beis Yaakov who goes to seminary with the full blessing of her parents. What does it mean to call her a Baalas Tshuva? I think she describes, and I'll say frum for an entire life, you know, wore a shaitel, had seven kids, etc., lived in Zurich. She says that when she went to Beis Yaakov in 1934, I believe, no, it might have been a little bit after, because she doesn't mention Sarah Schneer, maybe 35 or 36. She went under duress. She had no interest in going to Beis Yaakov. She wanted to go to the university. And as a matter of fact, while she was in Beis Yaakov Seminary, she was also attending the University of Warsaw secretly behind her father's back. And it was a kind of deal she had with her mother that if she went to Beis Yaakov Seminary, her mother would look the other way while she also went to university. So she was a rebel. She thought Beis Yaakov was going to be some horribly orthodox, stifling place. She went under dress. Her best friend in the seminary, by the way, was Rivka Alter, the Gerab's daughter. And in the seminary, the first class with Yehuda Leib Orlean, the director at that point, basically brought her back to Judaism. She fell in love with his teaching, with his style, with his ability to, she writes about his ability to connect with these sensitive, questioning souls. So let me just close the door because I could hear somebody cooking. Thanks. I live in a small house with a lot of people. So how did this affect? So Gutta Sternbuch, one way of describing her experience in Beis Yaakov is that she went from being questioning, skeptical, really, she makes it sound like on the verge of leaving the Orthodox world, to being drawn back into the Orthodox world again. And I think maybe it's pushing it to call her a Balas Tshuva, but I think that there's something about that lens that helps us see certain characteristics of Beis Yaakov. And let me give you some other examples of what I mean. So Beis Yaakov, unlike Beis Yaakov today, and I'll just say that Beis Yaakov today is the subject of the last lecture, which is going to be next week. And this is one way in which Beis Yaakov is no longer a Baal Tshuva movement. It no longer has missionary hopes and dreams. It makes no attempt to reach out and bring people into Orthodoxy. There's plenty of stuff happening like that in the Orthodox world, but Beis Yaakov is not where it happens. Beis Yaakov was where it happened in the interwar period. There were, for instance, the Beis Yaakov actively marketed to secular families or modern Orthodox families, etc. And we know this from, I have here the cover of a youth autobiography. Some of our richest sources about Beis Yaakov are from this collection of youth autobiographies that Max Weinreich, he had a autobiography contest in the 1930s, a few contests, and these autobiographies were discovered in a garage in Vilnius. And we now have, you know, on the ground kind of stories of some of the richest stories we have about Beis Yaakov are from these youth autobiographies. And we know that Beis Yaakov, from one of these youth autobiographies, not the one pictured, by someone named Esther, who talks about being in Beis Yaakov, that we know that they were encouraged in her Benos group to reach out to their secular friends or to their off the derech friends and to try to bring them back to Orthodoxy. And Beis Yaakov actually had to deal with what was called the Hashpah problem or Hashpah problem. You see in the Beis Yaakov Journal articles that talk about this problem of having friends that aren't Orthodox. On the one hand, they wanted people to have friends that weren't Orthodox because that was the way that girls were brought back to Orthodoxy. On the other hand, they felt that, what if it went the other way around? You have a Beis Yaakov girl who's friends with a socialist, and the socialist girl happens to be a little more charismatic or persuasive, and next thing you know, the Beis Yaakov girl is a socialist. So there was a kind of discomfort around its missionary basic impulse. And Besyakov walked a fine line. And in the first of the surveys that they sent out to Besyakov in the 1920s, they actually asked, this is part of the democratic spirit of Besyakov, they actually asked the people responding to the surveys, how should we finesse this? Do we want to move more toward the missionary, toward the reaching out, the trying to Kirov, what we now call Kirov poll? Or do we want to isolate ourselves a little bit? Do we want to keep ourselves within the fold? And they actually didn't take a stand, and they tried to have it both ways. And the play was one way in which they marketed to everybody, all the Jewish families in a given town. And what that meant is that the classes often had a mixture of people from real Orthodox families and people from not Orthodox families. This is, as I said, one of the main reasons that Hasidic rebbes didn't want their own families to send their daughters there. This also meant that the Besyakov journal was full of stories of people who had come back to Orthodoxy. So they love, this is one of the main things that the Besyakov girls loved to read about, was, you know, famous actresses or whatever, people who came back to their Jewish roots. And then just as my final piece, I just have a picture there. I'll explain why I have that picture on the top there, but the picture on the left, I've already mentioned this family. That's Nathan Berenbaum seated on the chair, himself a Baal Tshuva, his son Shlaima Berenbaum, to say the Ashkenazic pronunciation. And I'll talk a little bit about Shlaima Berenbaum. He's an important character in this story. And the young man, Shlaima's son, young boy, is Jacob Berenbaum. And some of you, that name might be familiar. Jacob Berenbaum, this is an astonishing family, every single one of them. Jacob Berenbaum was the founder of Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry. So in every generation, this family accomplished something. So this family, I would argue, who became Baalei Tshuva, Nathan Berenbaum became a Baal Tshuva around the year 1911, bringing his four children with him, who all remained Orthodox. And as far as I know, all the descendants continue to be Orthodox, many of them in Toronto, so some of your neighbors. But he really was a little bit of an insider outsider in the world of Aguda, even though he became the general, I'm talking about Nathan now, I think it was called the executive director or secretary. It was actually called secretary of the World Aguda. He was appointed in the late 1920s. There was always a little bit of a suspicion about him and his crazy ideas in what could be called the mainstream of the Aguda. And I think that had to do with the fact that he was a German Jew. It had to do with the fact that he was a Baal Tshuva. He was a maverick. He actually developed a lot of his ideas about Orthodoxy without close connections to any, I mean, I think he made his first real Orthodox, Eastern European Orthodox friend sometime during the First World War. That was Tuvia Horowitz, who was the Vizhnitzer Rebbe's nephew, who became his dear, dear friend and really showed him what it's like to be, you know, a kind of Eastern European ultra-Orthodox Jew. And Nathan Berenbaum loved it, but the feelings were not reciprocated, except among Besyakov. So there were certainly people, let's say, in the left of the Aguda in Poland, who had a serious interest in Nathan Berenbaum. But, you know, who's this Nathan Berenbaum guy? You can imagine that there's some, he's not the Chafetz Chaim, he's not a Rosh Hashiva, he's not Meir Shapiro. In Besyakov, he was their guy. And evidence of this is all over the journal. I mean, there's a special issue devoted to him. with photos of him. He himself traveled throughout the Beis Yaakov world. The photo on the top, I don't know how why it came out as a mirror image, but it's taken in the summer program, the Beis Yaakov summer program in the resort town of Rabka in 1930. And I found it in a family scrapbook in the Birnbaum house in Toronto. Nathan Birnbaum loved Beis Yaakov, and Beis Yaakov loved Nathan Birnbaum. And my suspicion is that the love had something to do with Nathan Birnbaum being the Baal Tshuva of the Aguda, the most famous Baal Tshuva. I mean, obviously the Orthodox world had other Baal Tshuva into our period. Franz Rosenzweig, certainly well known. But Nathan Birnbaum, who really fell in love with Eastern European Jewry and believed that they were the hope of all Jews, his particular charisma was felt most powerfully among the women of the Aguda. And I think I talked earlier about how German Jewish influence was permitted in Polish Eastern Orthodoxy, but only up to the line, onto the gender line, only among women. So Nathan Birnbaum would have been accepted by women more than men, even if he wasn't a Baal Tshuva. But the adoration that was felt for him, more than for people than like Leo Deutschlander, the seeing him as a kind of guru of the movement, had something to do with the fact that so many of the girls themselves were, in the sense that I'm trying to put it, themselves Baalei Tshuva, even if they had come from, even if they had grown up in Orthodox homes. Nathan Birnbaum's children were already, you know, in their teens and 20s when he became a Baal Tshuva. So it wasn't simply a matter of being, well, of course they're Baalei Tshuva, you know, the family becomes from. They themselves chose the same lifestyle, the same world that their father had chosen. And Shlomo Birnbaum was, this is part of later in this talk, he was a Yiddish professor at the University of Hamburg, and he became the Yiddishist of the Orthodox world, and in particular of Beis Yaakov. So let me say one more thing. I think it's also significant that the Birnbaum family was so influential in bringing a kind of love for art, the arts, we could say, into the Beis Yaakov movement, into the Aguda. So if anyone who's done research on the Aguda and into our period, you'll see over and over again, amazing graphic design, mostly without any kind of attribution. And I myself used the image, this image on the right, I had in my book without knowing where it came from, because I wasn't yet in touch with the Birnbaums in Toronto. And when I went to their family archive, David Birnbaum pulls out the work of Oriel Birnbaum, the family artist, and there's the image, and I read what it says in Hebrew, and I understand this is an image that was appropriated for Beis Yaakov purposes, despite the fact that I don't think the image was produced to illustrate a verse about girls. It was a verse about boys. By the way, this kind of appropriation of things that were not written with women in mind or drawn with women in mind by a movement, an Orthodox women's movement, is not unique to their appropriation of Oriel Birnbaum. Basically, almost all the ways in which they rooted themselves in Orthodoxy were appropriations or borrowings or transgenderings, since Orthodox, let's say the traditional Jewish canon or traditional Jewish writings, don't actually provide a lot of legitimation or inspiring passages about how wonderful it is that girls are studying Torah. So Beis Yaakov took their stuff where they could find it. Even the name Beis Yaakov was evidence of that, right? They find a Rashi or a Midrash that says, Ko Tamar Levet Yaakov, Elu Hanashim, there you go. That's the evidence that not only was the Torah directed to girls and women, but it was directed to girls and women first. So you could see how powerful that Midrash was for Beis Yaakov. There are many other things like that. So if Uriel's art is one of them, that's just another example. So Uriel Birnbaum produced, I think, much of this amazing art. He produced that Pushka, the Keren HaTorah Pushka. Keren HaTorah was the fund that supported the Beis Yaakov Seminary along with the Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin and other of the Aguda yeshivas and schools in Poland. It's a beautiful Pushka. I wish I owned it. If any, you know, if it ever shows up in an auction again, I'm going to pay for it and maybe use it, put money in it. On the left, this was interesting to me because L'chavod Rav Wolf Pappenheim, Liyom Layat Lo Shmonim Shana, it's a kind of donation. So Wolf Pappenheim, I've already mentioned his daughter, Bertha Pappenheim, the feminist patient of Breuer, patient zero of psychoanalysis, who worked on behalf of Beis Yaakov, was on the board. Her father was a kind of Chassam Sofer Jew who migrated to Vienna. And he obviously didn't need any money. In honor of his 80th birthday, there were things you could donate money to, including Keren HaTorah. But look what beautiful art there was. So among the reasons that I think Beis Yaakov was so enamored of the Birnbaum family was also the fact that they had an artist among them, Uriel Birnbaum, who died in the Netherlands in the 50s and was, I guess I would call him modern Orthodox his entire life. The Beis Yaakov Journal always hoped to have enough money to have more art, and they actually championed Jewish women artists and looked for them too. So the it's astonishing that this article, they published an article about an Orthodox Jewish woman, a Dutch artist named Anna Halperin, who was actually a ceramics artist with no illustration. But in any case, they had the art of Uriel Birnbaum, and buried under the cornerstone of the Beis Yaakov Seminary building in Krakow. I just paid to have it photographed by a Polish art photographer, is a some kind of, I'm not sure if it's a paper or stone, but a kind of document that Uriel Birnbaum made and buried. So he was at the heart of Beis Yaakov education, which included a great interest in art. I think I'm putting this under the general category of what to call the Baal Tshuva character of Beis Yaakov. And I'm curious to know what you think of this. I'm just floating this idea. So the other half of the idea that Beis Yaakov was a Baal Tshuva movement is also the prevalence of, let's say, OTD in this world. And the closeness of, I think that Baal Tshuva and OTD, off the derech, people leaving Orthodoxy, that these are very closely connected phenomena. And what they mean is that the borders between the secular world and the ultra-Orthodox world were unusually blurry and subject to people going one way or the other. Jay, tell me, just you can nod. Did I already talk about Shmuel Nadler in this?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so if I'm sorry if
somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember.
So let me tell you a little bit about one of the characters I'm talking about, and we're fortunate enough to have a photo of him, so he's in the slideshow. But since this is also about girls, I also have another girl I want to tell you about. So these are people who moved from the world of Beis Yaakov to the world of communism, which turns out to not be such a big step as you might think. So Shmuel Nadler is an interesting character, if anyone has heard of him. He was the Gera Chassid. Can you see the whole slide? Let me move
So we see two pictures on the bottom right.
One when he's not. Great. So Shmuel Nadal, let me tell you a little bit about him. Ger Chassid, who has a literary bent. Now, let's say that being a Ger Chassid and wanting to be a poet, it's not clear how those things work together in every era. But in the 1920s and 1930s, it was possible. Shmuel Nadler, he's called by various people the Aguda Bard. Aguda had a bard. Not the Aguda today. I don't think it has a bard. Or unless you call, Yontif Erlich or somebody a bard. And there were other poets in the Orthodox world, but there were very few poets. There's also a woman. I'll talk about her in a minute. There were very few poets who had any status within the Orthodox world and also within the secular world. So Shmuel Nadler was, let's call him he had a great crossover hit. His crossover hit was called Die Besht Symphonia. It was a book-length poem about the Baal Shem Tov. It came out when he was like 19 or 20. I mean, I think he's really like, doesn't even have a beard because he's so young, not because he's modern in this photo. And he would give talks, he would give readings, and the readings would be packed with Ger Chassidim, his buddies, and his fellow Tzirei Agudas Yisrael people, and they'd be packed with the secular Yiddishists who loved him. It's like they were waiting for someone like him. So that's who Shmuel Nadler was. He wrote the hymn, B'nos Agudas Yisrael hymn, which is the winning anthem. They had, in 1929, they had a contest with a prize. And for anybody who wants to try to write the anthem of the youth movement. And Shmuel Nadler won. Eliezer Schindler also put one in, but he didn't win. And he got the prize money. Let me tell you about how Shmuel Nadler left the Orthodox world. And if you read this closely, you could see it elsewhere. I forget where I have it, but it's already maybe a little bit of a hint that he might be on his way out. But it at least seems to be from the, it was pious enough to win, let's just say that. And it's a love poem to Orthodox women. Tznius von der Mutter Sora und der Mutter Rivka's Geist. What is it? Something von der Mutter Tränen von der Mutter Leia. So, all the four mothers. It also speaks in the voice of a Jewish woman. Komm zu uns, a weite Schwester. Come to us, O distant sisters. So you can already see the missionary impulse in Beis Yaakov. But I love that it's a man speaking in the first person feminine plural. Us, he's identifying with, that's how deep his identification was with Benos. But he was writing the hymn. So I already told you that Beis Yaakov was famous for its theater crazy culture. And the theater crazy culture led to boys in Tzirei Agudas Yisrael, the male youth movement, wanting to do the kind of theater that the girls were doing. And this story actually is about how Shmuel Nadler left the Orthodox world. And Shmuel Nadler was giving a poetry reading at a Tzirei Agudas Yisrael clubhouse in Warsaw. And the boys in the clubhouse gave him an earful about something that had just happened to them, which is that they had just decided to put on an evening of performances the way girls were doing it in the small towns. They were going to do it in Warsaw. They'd been rehearsing for, this is Hanukkah time. It's not a Purim spiel. So this is not a borrowing. This is not a kind of modern rewriting of the Purim spiel. This is a new phenomenon, which is Tzirei Agudas Yisrael attempt to imitate Beis Yaakov girls in terms of Hanukkah extravaganzas. So they're ready to put on their Hanukkah extravaganza. Word gets out to the Aguda that this is happening. And no one's asked them. No one's run the script by them. No one's And they come down hard on this chapter of Tzirei Agudas Yisrael, and they're like, let's see the script. Is the script kosher? What's it about? Who's in it? Is it sexual segregation? They decide, and the boys get a little chutzpahdik. One of them says, you know, is it, you can do Mechiras Yosef, right? The traditional story of the selling of Joseph. And one of them says, so one of us should play Eshes Potiphar. So one of us should play the wife of Potiphar. In other words, in the name of being kosher, we're going to have to cross dress. And the Aguda didn't like this chutzpah, and they shut down the production. Shmuel Nadler heard about this. He was already probably having a little bit of problems with the Aguda, overstepping the limits that they were putting on him. In any case, a few days later, his big talk at the Warsaw Pen Club. This is already January 1934, and he shows up at the Warsaw Pen Club, and no yarmulke, and he's cut off his payas, and he announces that he's now a communist, and the Aguda is a decrepit old organization, and nobody should be in it. And in the meantime, the room is half filled with Ger Hasidim, half filled with secular Jews. You can imagine they have different reactions to this sight. His brother, who happens to look almost exactly like him, yells, "My brother's been possessed by a dibbuk," and he faints. And this is how the story gets. This story is just too wild, and there's too many people there for this not to be in all the sensational Yiddish press. So this is a story of Shmuel Nadler. Shmuel Nadler moves to Paris a week later, joins the Communist Party in Paris, and is not seen again in Orthodox circles. So this is an example of a certain kind of dangerous openness that existed between the Aguda and the secular world. And Shmuel Nadler lived more or less comfortably or uncomfortably within this double world until he couldn't anymore. The example I have of a Beis Yaakov girl who did this is a girl named Chan Shebele Holstock, who we know about only from the Sefer Porisov, which is the Yiskar book of the town of Porisov. The town of Porisov, and in the Yiskar book, it tells her story. It says that she was in a nearby town, a well-educated Beis Yaakov girl, and when the Aguda and Porisov decided it's time to open a Beis Yaakov, they brought her in from the next town, and she set up shop in Porisov, and she immediately became not only a kind of superstar, charismatic Beis Yaakov teacher and Benos leader, but also had all these Tzirei Agudas Yisrael young boys also studying at her feet, which is a little not exactly the way the Aguda envisioned these two youth movements operating. But everything, she was so charismatic and she's so apparently devoted to the Aguda that people looked the other way. Until one day, a shipment of books from Warsaw for the Benos Library was mislabeled and ended up in the wrong house. And somebody opened up this book, the shipment of books, and it's communist literature. And the rumor goes around town that Chan Shebele is a communist, and she's basically run out of town. And there's such turmoil in the wake of her leaving that basically Aguda falls apart in that town entirely. The Beis Yaakov falls apart, everything. Now, the implication in the Sefer Parasov is that she was some kind of double agent. She was a Beis Yaakov girl. She was a communist masquerading as a Beis Yaakov girl. I've actually read enough of these kinds of things. Gutta Sternbuch mentions another kind of overlap that actually Beis Yaakov probably had teachers, certainly students, who were both communists and certainly socialists, and also Besyakov girls, that the border, despite the fact that Besyakov was officially anti-communist, as it was anti-Zionist, as it was anti-socialist, etc., the fact that the Aguda had a socialist party, the fact that there were these kinds of blurry borders between socialists, communists, Zionists, and even Besyakov, means that it's extremely possible that what you had in Parisov was a Besyakov teacher who was also not secretly a communist, maybe secretly, but equally a communist and a Besyakov girl. I really think that that's at least as likely an explanation as that she was some kind of double agent. And I think that this describes something of the, I talked about the blurriness of the borders and the restlessness of the youth of this period, that people went back and forth between the Orthodox world and the non-Orthodox world, and sometimes even tried to live impossible double lives, like Gutta getting her PhD and also working in the seminary. Okay, just quickly, two more things to look at. When do we stop? I should stop at like in 8 minutes, 10 minutes, right?
No, I'd go a little longer. Go to
the Q&A.
There are not so many questions. I'm following.
Okay. So Orthodox Yiddishism. So first of all, what does that even mean? Like people are just, why would you need, of course, Besyakov were Yiddish speakers, right? So when I talk about Yiddishism as an influence on Besyakov, that seems like a kind of absurd thing to say, because obviously, you know, we're talking about Eastern European Jews in Poland. What else would they be but Yiddish speakers? I've already talked about the role of German in the seminary, for instance. But now I just want to talk about what Yiddishism was. What I mean when I say that Besyakov was not a Yiddish-speaking movement, it was a Yiddishist movement. Now, obviously, I don't mean it was a Yiddishist movement in the sense of secular Yiddishism. It was a Yiddishist movement in the sense of Orthodox Yiddishism. And what I mean is that Yiddish as a value was not evident in the early years of Besyakov. The first 6 years of Besyakov's journal, it was published in Yiddish and in Polish. And when people talked about going to only Yiddish, others said, how are we going to have only Yiddish? I mean, we have to reach Polish-speaking girls. Even Orthodox Jews in the big cities even Hasidim were already speaking Polish. Sereshner herself wrote her diary in Polish. Besyakov took on Yiddishism in 1929. It was one of the last influences of the great influences of socialism, feminism, etc. Yiddishism was the last one. And as further evidence that it wasn't a sort of natural part of the environment of Besyakov is the fact that it was imported. It was imported, and how was it imported? It was imported from Germany through the Birnbaum family. The Birnbaum family sent visitors everywhere they went in Eastern Europe. They said, Nathan Birnbaum, Schleimer Birnbaum, they said, you people don't understand what you're giving up. You have an amazing language called Yiddish. You must keep to Yiddish. You must embrace Yiddish fully and wholeheartedly. They worked tirelessly to revive revive Yiddish in Besyakov. They also wanted to revive it elsewhere. They wanted to also influence yeshivas and places like that, where Polish was also making inroads. They also wanted to teach Eastern European, in other words, who wrote the textbooks and who did the scientific research on Eastern European Orthodox Yiddishism? It was the Barenbaum family. It was a German family coming to Eastern Europe and trying to persuade Eastern European Orthodox Jews to embrace their Yiddish and to also embrace the Orthodox Galicianer pronunciation against the Yivo secular pronunciation, and to try to systematize Orthodox Yiddish, which didn't occur to people